Thank you.
Okay, our final presentation this morning is adopting a people, process, and technology strategy to drive sustainable workforce optimization. Our presenter is Greg Karagian. Greg is the Regional Vice President North America for Immersive Technologies. He's worked at Immersive Technologies in a variety of roles for the past 13 years. During this time, he has worked extensively with mining organizations to design new-to-world products, spearheading Immersive Technologies' entry into the underground mining, and most recently, heading up the North American operations. He's currently the Regional Vice President of North America and has a master's degree in business administration from Curtin University. How about a warm welcome for Greg?
Thanks. These Australians are like a plague, aren't they? Can't get rid of them. We're not all bad. I've lived here in the States now for 7 or 8 years, so I think I'm somewhat naturalized to the culture of the US. Acclimated somewhat. Just give me a moment. So, this is an interesting crowd to talk to because basically every mine in here is already one of our customers. So rather than this being talking to you about the technology side of things, which naturally most people would expect from a simulation company, instead what we're going to focus on is, well, results we've accomplished with our customers, but also, more importantly, where things come apart, where implementation of technology doesn't hit the high mark, or we can't maintain successes, and what the common causes for that are. So we have specialists that deal with this internally. Immersive has an entire team of advisors that deal specifically with implementation. I'm not one of those specialists, so I'll just be giving you a cursory overview. But for any of those who look at this and say, okay, that's something I want to know more about, we'd naturally be happy to set up a meeting with one of our advisors to talk about how we can make that happen further. But a lot of these things will be common sense to you, and many of you have been through these processes before, so in many ways it's more of a refresher and a reminder of what we can do to perform better. All right, the button works. Fantastic. So I know there are going to be people in the room who have not seen a simulator before, so cursory images. You're going to get 2 slides of technology in this, and that's it. So the basics, the simulators at their most basic level are an analog for a real piece of heavy equipment. Instead of training inside a real truck and having the additional risk and cost of doing that, you can train inside the simulated environment, which is safer and cheaper, et cetera, all the basics. Now, the other thing that a simulator does is it provides a consistent measurement tool for the behaviors of your operators. And realistically, that's a far more valuable thing to you. Much like Pit Ram is measuring and giving you data and information on your fleet, we're doing the same thing on your people. And so this is just the fundamentals of, you know, this is what a simulator does. And I'm sure a lot of you in the crowd are already well aware of this, but I know there are vendors here and whatnot that haven't been through this before. There are a few different configurations depending on what you're trying to do with them at a few different price points, but fundamentally, they have a display system, a motion system, most of the time audio systems, et cetera. And then you can install different cabins for a truck or a shovel or a dozer or whatever it is you're trying to train on. So hopefully that gives you the basics for how this all fits together. Okay. When it comes to implementing these in the field, really, there are 4 stages we deal with when it comes to workforce development. The first and most rudimentary is recruitment and selection. You want to hire, say, 100 people from an indigenous population or a local town. You need to bring new people in. You might have 500 candidates. Which ones are you going to prioritize and take off the top and bring into the next stage of your training program? Using the simulator, you can use it to objectively measure performance. We recently did this with Rio Tinto. They needed to hire, I can't remember how many people it was, I think they fed 60 people through our offices. We processed all of these new applicants. They don't know anything about them beyond their resumes, and we can give them an objective score of this is how this cohort behaves, and here's a bell curve of where all the people sit in terms of their relative riskiness to an operation. That's the most basic level of workforce development. New operator onboarding is where you take that cohort and then you actually train them. make them competent. So get them to a point where you think, okay, I trust this guy to drive my $4 million truck. Maybe not trust, maybe it's the best you've got access to, but you know, you're gonna get them to a competent level and you're gonna put them in the field and they're gonna be operating in field. And a lot of the time, this is where people stop. That's the end of it. People will get to this point, and sometimes that can be satisfactory for markets that have high turnover, low skills markets, these sorts of things. But where the real value starts coming into this is the latter stages. The first being profiling, where we actually bring experienced operators back in. And we take them through a baselining process, and we measure their behaviors. We get them to do something they do every day. Go drive to that dump and come back again. We're not giving them any feedback, we're measuring their behaviors, and we're seeing what latent risks may exist in your workforce. You probably know who your high performers are, but you probably don't know what abuse they're doing to your equipment. You may not know how they'd respond to an emergency, and so we're able to capture that and quantify it in an objective way and provide an assessment of a workforce in terms of how risky people are, from the most risky to the least risky, based off what's important to you. And then the final stage there being workforce optimization and maintenance, where you take that information and actually execute it in the field, looking at real-world data out of dispatch systems, monitoring machine health information, production data, and using the behavioral information, identifying where the biggest opportunities for improvement are, and then delivering a continuous improvement activity. And I know a number of you in the room here have already done this, but just walking through the basic stages. Obviously, this is where you're gonna get the most value. When you're just dealing with competency, you've got bums in seats, you've got people operating your equipment, it's business as usual. This is where the opportunity for real return on investment begins. Typically, the focus is going to be in one of these three categories, maybe a couple of them for a given organization. It's going to shift depending on where you are in your mine life cycle or what the current issues of the day are, be it safety, productivity, or equipment health. Obviously, safety is something that simulation is usually more traditionally associated with because it's something that's very hard to train for in the field. You don't necessarily want to have to set off a fire extinguisher on the real machine and then have to go refill it every time. You can't train for most emergencies in a simulated environment. You can do it again and again and again, and you can assess it again and again and again. So it's very useful for managing these things you can't measure in the field. But of course, the real dollar signs are going to start flowing in when you're talking about increasing cycle times for productivity or reducing maintenance costs or maintenance hours by reducing abuse on the equipment. So these things will vary based off where you are in your mine's life. But all of these processes have the same thing in common, and that's that we want to reduce the average. So when we're measuring the risk of your organization, whatever that means to you, be it you want to improve productivity or maintenance or whatnot, you want to shift that so you're into a lower risk category, but you also want to reduce the variance. And you know, obviously we want to make our operations more productive by reducing the average, but when we reduce the variance, obviously that's more significant for things like the reliability of what's coming into the mill, the spread of the risk. It's no good having a great average if you've got some lunatics out there in a couple of trucks, but the average looks good. So we're focusing on reducing the spread as well as shifting the average. Everyone entertained? I know it's a very quiet room. Just make sure everyone's good. We're good? Good. We'll keep moving. I told you there's no technology in this. So here are some averages. We've run over 50 continuous improvement projects around the world, and these are some averages on the types of projects that we've run. And what you can see here is in gray, that is the average of all of our projects in a given category. And the yellow represents the worst variance or the best rate of improvement, however you want to look at it, be it money left on the table or savings achieved by bothering to invest in your workforce. And so you can see it can be fairly startling. When you're looking at things like emergency pass rates, typically it's quite a large shift because it's usually a binary thing. Once you know this, you're able to get a huge amount of improvement. So you can see there that emergency pass rates have gone from 2% in some mine all the way back up to 98% in terms of pass rates, a massive improvement. But on average, it's about 50% improvement. Usually it's a fairly large step change function. But things like, you know, fuel, while it might be at the bottom of the list in terms of figures, even achieving the average of 7%, I mean, what does a 7% fuel burn reduction mean to you guys? That's some serious money. And we're seeing that pretty consistently. So across all of these categories, anything that you can measure in the field, we can measure within the simulation. So the only question is, what's the operational focus for you? So you can see there's a massive opportunity for improvement, but frankly, there's a lot of money being left on the table. Just to give you an example of real-world operator variability, this chart is taken off the dig rates from some hydraulic excavators in Australia. Across the bottom, there are individuals whose names have been omitted. And if you look at this black line here, what you can see is the instantaneous dig rate, or basically the tonnage. What's the productive rate of that equipment? And there's a 73% variation between the best and the worst operators. You can see the best guy up here, over 8,000 tons per hour, and then down here you've got someone under 4,000. There's staggering variation for the same piece of equipment in the same environment. So, massive opportunity there. Now, in this particular project, the rate of improvement was 8% for the instantaneous dig rate, as well as a host of other improvements. But the point is, this variation is real, and it's enormous. I include this example, I know there aren't many underground operations, if any, present in this room today, but I include this example because it's an interesting case study in the value of training in a systematic function, because not only is that variance present and can be addressed, but it's also something that is not addressed as a one-off hit. So what you can see here in the light gray is the baselining that took place for experienced operators at quite a small underground silver mine in Mexico. And it was a very large spread and very risky scores. Across the board, these guys hadn't had real training beyond the basic, you buy a truck, the guy turns up, they show you where the keys are and where the manual is, and they wish you a good day. We brought them in for their initial baselining, and then following training, there was a significant drop, almost two-thirds reduction in how risky their behaviors were. But what's interesting here is that 3 months later, we went back in and did the same thing again and dropped it again. So the overall improvement by doing follow-up training was almost 88%. So my point is, if you think that because you trained your operator back in the 80s, that guy is still going to be competent today, you're getting the most out of him, it's a mistake. People are variable. I mean, you guys know what it was like when you got your driver's license. You did everything right. You stopped at every stop sign completely for 3 seconds, and you walked around your car before you got into it. How many people walked around their car before they drove out of the airport today, when they drove on in here? Any hands? No one, right? And this is the point. People are sloppy. I got a giggle back there. At least it's entertaining. And this is pretty widespread. North America's been a fantastic champion of getting results out of our products. And what you can see on this map here is, although it's completely invisible on this projector, is different results have been accomplished throughout North America. So this variance is a common phenomenon across commodities, across all areas of the world. We've just highlighted North America, obviously, because of the audience. So you can see here that massive improvements across the board all around the North American market. So these problems are widespread and common because you all employ people. Until Komatsu or Caterpillar have AHS running comprehensively across every surface mine, or Hitachi or LeBear, this is gonna continue to be a pretty significant problem for us. So this is more of a diagnostic, this slide, but it's some of the common problems as to why reasons for why these things start to fall apart. So, as I said, almost everyone here that's a mining company actually already owns one of our products. So we've got a fair amount of experience with when things work and when things don't work. And it falls into two categories. The first is people who don't know they've got a problem. And the second category is they know they've got a problem, but they really aren't set up to address it. And the first and most obvious is people. So typically, the training department is typically quite a skilled person. Sometimes it's a guy with a bad back. Sometimes it's someone no one can stand working with. But typically, they don't really have the support that they need to deliver on these sorts of activities. So they might be deficient in skills because they don't know how to do instructional design, or they may not know how to do quantitative analysis. They may not know how to crack into pit RAM and get all the figures out of it. They may not be very gifted at Excel. Could be any number of reasons, but they can't get it across the line. Or maybe they've just got the wrong KPIs. They're not remunerated based on performance of the mine. They're getting paid based on how many people they pump through. They're probably flooded just dealing with basic MSHA and OSHA compliance. But on the tail end of that, there may not be a continuous improvement culture. So they may know they've got a problem, but they know, listen, what keeps you in the job here is keep ticking the boxes, make sure everything's covered. Everything else isn't my problem. So I'm not going to step through all of this, but the next problem is obviously process. So people don't know they've got a problem because they've got all of this wonderful information at their fingertips. People don't know how to analyze it. They don't systematically analyze it. It's not part of their decision-making processes. Or there's so much noise in the data. There might be faulty sensors. Maintenance doesn't care about fixing up sensors. So the data coming in is garbage. There's no process to ensure it's been monitored correctly. We've walked into operations where they thought they were recording everything. They hadn't recorded any data in a year. Now, I don't know what's more criminal, the OEM that sold them the system that wasn't recording data, or the mine that bought a system and didn't look at the information for a year. Anyway. And then finally, technology, which is typically the thing we all try and touch on, right? Everyone thinks we can buy a magic box that'll solve all of our woes. But as I said, almost all of you already have our technology, so it's kind of a moot point. The technology can do all of these wonderful things, but what's stopping us from delivering on it? So I wanted to break this down, and you guys get to be my guinea pig for this new slide. And I apologize for the people at the back, because I know the text is kind of hard to read all the way back there, but work with me here. So when we're talking about people, we're talking about your trainers, your instructional designers, subject matter experts, data analysts. We'll get into that more in a second. When we're talking about processes, it could be, say, train the trainer, how to integrate curricula, because you've all got bits and pieces of curricula from all over the place. You know, CAT will give you some e-learning, and you have some SOPs you develop internally, and you've got our simulator program. How do you bring all of that together? And then continuous improvement processes. How do you actually get this stuff off the ground? From a technology perspective, it could be simulators, but it also could be e-learning or VR content or whatever works for the problem you're having. But the first and probably the most important issue is having the wrong people. Because if you don't have the right people, you're not going to have the skills to deliver on the project. There's no stakeholder involvement, which is a massive problem. You know, a lot of the technical work in this can be overcome, but if you don't get all the right people around the table, you're not going to get a production manager releasing someone for training. Why should he? He should be more productive in the field, right? Until he understands the money he's leaving on the table. And most importantly, a champion. Who's going to run this thing? Who's going to actually get this off the ground and make sure it delivers? So there's a lot of people, and we clump the trainers in this in an isolated fashion, but really this is an organizational change problem. So how do we manage that? You might have the wrong processes, and this is quite a common problem. You might have a single set of training processes which are designed for onboarding green operators, which is fantastic, but then when you've got an experienced operator coming on board, he looks at the materials, he's like, this is useless to me, I know what I'm doing, why are you doing this, it lacks relevance. Or even worse, you may not have any processes, it may be completely inconsistent training. You may have a trainer that just does ride-alongs and he just does it based off his gut and he says, yeah, that guy's good, that guy isn't, and that guy's my friend, so he's going to drive a truck anyway. And the wrong technology. So you might be trying to use a sledgehammer to crack a walnut. So depending on the problem you're trying to solve, there might be a better suited technology to deliver on it. PowerPoint's great, but it's got its limitations. I don't think I'm going to win any of you over today just with a PowerPoint presentation in terms of changing your organizational culture. It's probably going to take a little bit more than that. And similarly, sometimes a simulator isn't the right tool. Sometimes it may be more effective to have a training video or something of that nature. So using the right technology of the problem so you're efficiently solving it. And what we're looking for when we're talking about results is, as I said before, the reduction in that variance, shifting the mean or improving the overall operational risk, and most importantly, making sure it's sustainable. Because as we showed with that example from Mexico, people slump and people don't always get the full response rate out of just one training session. So how do you make it systemic so that it's something that's continually delivering improvement, not just being a one-shot project? Specifically looking at people, I just want to give you an idea of a typical project org chart for us to get an idea of how much is involved here. So yes, we have the training staff out here by the side, and they're responsible for delivery. So they'll be given a curricula. They may help develop the curricula. But you need a lot more than that. You need the champion who's working with mine management to get this thing across the line. Mine management's going to be defining what the organizational targets are and empowering staff underneath them, maintenance managers, production managers, training managers, to actually deliver on the project. But then, But then underneath this project champion, or maybe underneath the training staff, depending on how you view it, there's a lot of other specialty skills that are required that typically don't exist on most mines. Data analysts, who's gonna go through your dispatch data? Who's gonna identify the signal from the noise? As I said, if you've got a sensor out, how do you know whether or not that information's relevant? Someone who can add context to information rather than just blindly relying off what's coming off a computerized system. Instructional designers to actually tailor a curricula that's targeted at the problem you're trying to solve. Not trying to get someone to sit through a week-long training course when you might be able to address it through some coaching in the field or something of that nature. And then CI specialists, people that understand continuous improvement, the processes, the methodology, what they're looking for, and how to get the most out of the project. There should be a lot of people involved in these sorts of things. But as I said, typically it's just getting delegated to the training staff who are already probably overworked and they're not getting it across the line. So we went through this list before, but something I wanted to touch on again is that all of these workforce development stages require a different set of processes. So when we talk about curricula, it's in effect a completely separate training process or a continuous improvement process based off where you're at. So trying to reapply what you're doing for screening, for workforce optimization, it's a fool's errand. One of the things we can offer you, which is typically, frankly, a complimentary service, or we can support you or run the whole thing for you, is process. We can help you with processes. We've run more of these projects than anyone else. We know what we're doing, it's field tested. So we've run 50 plus workforce development projects. Greenfield opportunities, you tell us when you're expecting the fleet on the ground, we work backwards and give you a project plan of community engagement, anticipated attrition rates of people going through training programs. You need 50 people in 2019, then you've got to start at this date with this. Basic stuff. We've trained over 2,000 of your on-site trainers, train the trainers. How do you do frontline work, the basics? How do you keep these sorts of programs up and running? Real straightforward stuff. We created 220 integrated curricula. So we turn up on your site. This isn't done remotely. We have staff all around the world that'll travel to your site, work with you on site, and integrate with the curricula you have. Because everyone's got pre-existing material that you need to bring back together. And so we've done that all around the world in a very consistent manner, and something we can assist you with. And this number's out of date, but we've run over 50 continuous improvement projects. So these are projects run in the field with our customers, validated results. If you come by the stand, you probably get something free from Ashley in our marketing department, but you can also pick up a book of case studies where we've got legal permission to reprint them in a limited context, so you can have a look at different examples of case studies of these projects where people have achieved these sorts of improvements. Information's there for you to take. And finally, something that we're doing quite a bit of these days is we entirely manage mine sites training programs for them. So we have over 20 managed resources around the world that are running simulation training programs and continuous improvement activities. So we have them in Canada, in the USA, Mexico, Chile, South Africa. What am I missing? Australia? I lose track of these things, there's too many of them. Anyway, so, and that's how we do it. That's how we accomplish these sorts of real results. Now you guys have the technology already, most of you. So there's nothing stopping you today from getting these sorts of results. And of course, you know, who wouldn't want to be accomplishing an average, 7% improvement in fuel loss or 10% improvement in tire life? These things are very accomplishable. So it's a question of what do you want to accomplish and how can we help you get there? So as I said, not much technology in this, but I thought given that you're all existing, mostly our customers, I thought it'd be a good opportunity to touch on these softer elements that success is contingent on. So that's it for me in terms of content. So I'm just curious from the rest of you, what kind of questions do you have? Is everyone aware they have a simulator? Everyone at Asarco know? Freeport? Everyone? No? Goldcorp? Yep.
Thank you for the presentation. How long, in your experience, takes to get an operator from zero to a decent level, track operator?
So curricular duration actually varies significantly based off the region. I'm not the best person to ask on this. So the training rates in Indonesia are quite different to the training duration, say, in Canada. So if you want, I can take your card and I'll put you in touch with one of the advisors that deal with curricular design services, and they can give you a spread. So they have an anticipated average based on the region, but I don't know them off the top of my head.
When you're running a training program for a mining company, do you have people on site or is this a remote?
Everything's done on site. So on one of those earlier slides, I don't think that's the back button?
Yeah.
Yeah? Wonderful. Let me go.
Trapdoor.
Exit stage left. This will take a few clicks. Let me bring this up. A few more clicks. We're almost there. There we go. So just in North America, each one of those red dots is where we have support or sales resources. Each one of the green dots is where we have a managed service installation. So all of those dots, the red and the green ones, are all staff locations. So the work is almost always, at least in some part, performed on site. Getting everyone together is a pretty key part of how we ensure success. If we could avoid that, we would avoid it. And we certainly have a lot of work on the back end to automate the more mundane processes of data cleanup. And there is a lot of work done on the back end in terms of curricular preparation, et cetera. But when it comes to getting everyone around the table to agree on what the goals are for the mine, that's got to be done on site.
I think one of the most important things that you set up there is retraining people. So we have people that come into the mines, then we give them their first training and they run equipment for 10 years and they learn a lot of bad habits in 10 years. And so I think one of the nice statistics that you show is how you can affect the retraining of our trained or specialized operators.
Absolutely. The response rate changes, again, operation to operation, country to country, but the attrition of knowledge and the collection of bad habits is almost universal. And typically where we see some quite interesting trends where your gun operators, the guys that are just smashing out the tons and the production manager loves them, they've typically got a lot of really bad habits. They're typically abusing the machines. And when you take them a look at them on balance in an objective view, although they may be the most productive, they may not necessarily be the most profitable. And a lot of them are the more experienced people. So it's there's definitely a lot of value in retraining and making it something that's systemic. And frankly, from what we've seen, even 6-month refresher is kind of the maximum. People rely on annual refreshers, but the retention rate really drops off after 6 months. No other questions?
Okay.
Well, I think, we're breaking just on time.
Perfect
for lunch.
Time, yeah.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Thank you. This concludes this morning's session.
Thank you.
Same plan as yesterday. Basically, you've got an hour break or so. Spend some time in the exhibit area. We'll be serving lunch at noon, same place, and then we'll reconvene.